Well, greetings and welcome back to a series of devotional reflections on the Pilgrim's Progress. We left off at in the middle of the scene at the Palace Beautiful, which is Bunyan's symbolism for the local church, the beautiful palace wherein weary pilgrims receive rest and refreshment. And Christian was dialoguing with the women of the house, the representative of the members of the church, where they were in a manner interviewing him concerning his Christian testimony and profession. And we were talking about how that's how membership in the church worked, that a potential new member was interviewed as to the legitimacy of his profession of faith in Christ. And he had discoursed with piety and with prudence, and we didn't quite get to Charity, who asks him about his family, which causes him great struggle, which causes him sorrow because he remembers his dear ones who refused to come with him on this pilgrimage. And Charity sort of gets in his business a little bit. And in an interesting way, she says, why didn't they come with you? What reason did they give? And he says, well, my wife was afraid of losing this world. My children were given to the foolish delights of youth. And so Charity says, but did you not with your vain life damp all that you by words used by way of your persuasion to bring them away with you? In other words, didn't you unsay with your life what you said with your words? Which is really quite a forward question, right? I mean, it's a presumption that, you know, you lived more poorly than you professed. And imagine yourself in a membership interview talking about why your spouse doesn't believe or why your children don't believe. And to have the examiner say to you, well, is it because you live an unruly life? Is it because your life unsays what you say with your mouth? wow. You know, that's a little bit in your face. And Bunyan's trying to tell us that this is what church is. This is what church membership is. It's a serious matter. And so you wondered how a Christian would respond to that and say, hey, you know, get out of my face. You know, that's really personal, or you're really in my business. Don't be so nosy. Don't be such a busybody. Not at all. Christian responds this way. Indeed, I cannot commend my life, for I am conscious to myself of many failings therein. I know also that a man by his conversation or his comportment, his behavior, may soon overthrow what by argument or persuasion he does labor to fasten upon others for their good. So he admits it. It's just a humble, you know what? I can't commend my life. There's nothing about my life in my former manner of life for certain that I can commend and say, no, I did this perfectly. And it's just a good lesson to us. You know, when somebody brings accusations against us or even questions us in a way that's uncomfortable, to be eager to admit fault and to recognize that, frankly, if they had known more, they would think worse of us. It's not that they think too bad of us because they don't know enough. It's not knowing as much as they could, they think quite better of us than they should. No matter how lowly they think of us. That's a good example there. But he says, you know, I do recognize that I was careful to not unsay with my behavior what I said with my mouth, and yet they still decided to stay. Well, eventually they all sit down to supper. They have a meal. And this is to picture the reality that the church nourishes its members, that there is not just rest and not just security from the outdoors, but there is nourishment. The table was furnished with fat things and with wine that was well refined, and all their talk at the table was about the Lord of the Hill. There again, coming back to what we saw last time about Christian spiritual conversation being the lifeblood of fellowship. When all the talk wasn't about the vain things of this world, the passing things of this life, but was about the Lord of the Hill, as namely about what he had done and wherefore he did what he did and why he had built that house. And by what they said, I perceived that he had been a great warrior, the Lord was, and had fought with and slain him that had the power of death, referring to Christ's conquest over Satan, but not without great danger to himself, which made me love him the more. And so the talk among the members of the church around the fellowship table whereby they are nourished is all about Christ and how he overcame Satan by his death. that he through death had conquered the one who had the power of death, Hebrews 2, 14 and 15. And so they continue to have their nourishment. And we need to look to the church as a place of nourishment, as a place that gives us spiritual food, as it proclaims the word of God, that builds us up and edifies us and gives us strength to undertake the journey that's before us. That the church isn't primarily to there for us to meet felt needs or to give us a sense of community or to make us feel like we're belonging or to, you know, stroke our egos, certainly. The church is there to nourish pilgrims so that they might serve, to equip the saints for the work of the ministry, Ephesians 4:12. That's what you're there to do. And then after dinner, they go to bed. And, you know, they discourse together till late at night. And after they had committed themselves to their Lord for protection, they betook themselves to rest. And just this notion of going into a bedroom and sleeping on a wearying journey is the idea that the church not only gives nourishment, but it gives spiritual rest. And it does, doesn't it? I mean, doesn't the church, as it proclaims the gospel, as it speaks the assurances of pardon, as it demonstrates its faith in Christ through the ordinances of baptism and the Lord's Supper, it gives rest to those who do battle with sin day in and day out throughout the week. But those great several hours on Sunday morning and then again on Sunday night, we leave all of that behind and we come for rest in the worship of God, to be ministered to and to minister to others. And then in the name of the chamber where he slept was called peace. And he wakes up in the morning after this peaceful rest, and he says in his poetry, "Where am I now? Is this the love and care of Jesus for the men that pilgrims are? Thus to provide that I should be forgiven and dwell already the next door to heaven." Not the best poetry, but he's breaking out into praise by saying, "I feel like I'm next door to heaven." And, you know, that's what the church is. It's next door to heaven. It's as much as close to heaven as we'll have on earth. And certainly there's quite a degree of, you know, standing far off from heaven. We are sinful still, and we're weighed down with our imperfections, and we see our corruptions. But the church is heaven on earth as much as heaven is going to be on earth in this age. And we need to regard it as such. And I know that so many of you, even by your own testimony, speak of it as such. Heaven on earth. I see that comment often. And I'm so thankful when I do. And that's my estimation of it. It's the assembly of the redeemed singing praises to God, praying to him, and feasting on his word together. I mean, that is glorious. And it's the occupation of heaven, albeit in a bit more perfect way. Well, in the morning they get up, and after some discourse, they told him that he should not depart till they had showed him the rarities of that place. And what we're going to see in these next pages is that the church not only nourishes, not only refreshes and gives rest, but it instructs. And so Bunyan takes them through all the, well, I should say Bunyan has the members of the household take Christian through all these different places to see the rarities of the house, the treasures of the church. First, they had him into the study where they showed him records of the greatest antiquity, in which, as I remember my dream, they showed him first the pedigree of the Lord of the Hill, that he was the son of the Ancient of Days and came by an eternal generation. So really interesting. The first thing that you hear about what the church teaches and instructs this pilgrim is the eternal generation of the Son, the deity of Christ, and as he stands in relation to the Father as Son. I mean, that's high doctrine, but you know what? It's the bedrock of the Christian life. Say, what's eternal generation? It's the doctrine that says that the Father is eternally the Father of the Son, and that the Son is eternally the Son from the Father. That in a way that's mysterious and beyond our comprehension, the Son is from the Father, from eternity. Not in a moment in time, not as the beginning of his existence, not at all, but an eternal generation, an eternal communication from the Father to the Son of the divine essence. I think of John chapter 5, certainly all the passages where Jesus is called the only begotten Son of God. That's not a reference merely to his birth as a human being. He is eternally begotten by the Father. And one of the things that Jesus says in John 5:26 is just as the Father has life in himself, just as the Father is we talk about the doctrine of aseity. He's from himself. He's perfectly self-sufficient. He depends on no one for his existence. Well, so also, he says, the Father gave to the Son to have life in him, in himself. The Son is ase. You know, he is self-sufficient. He has the same exact divine nature as the Father. But interestingly, the Father has it and then gives that to the Son. It almost seems contradictory. How can you have life in yourself but have that given to you? This is this incomprehensible, ineffable doctrine of eternal generation whereby the Father eternally communicates to the Son the divine essence. That's the beginning point for pilgrims. And it's so true because the deity of Christ and the triunity of God are the foundation of all of our faith. And if you're unfamiliar with that, if that sounds like a bunch of theological gobbledygook to you, I'd encourage you to get acquainted with those realities, to read some good theology books on the Trinity. MacArthur and Mayhew have a good section on eternal generation that would be of edification to you. Others that I could recommend, just ask me for them. But that's that struck me, that the first thing was a doctrine like that. Here was also, they say, more fully recorded the acts that he had done, which is what? The Gospels. And the names of many hundreds that he had taken into his service, and how he placed them in such habitations that he could neither by length of days nor decays of nature be dissolved. Then they read to him some of the worthy acts that some of his servants had done. I think that's the book of Acts. And then eventually, what is he saying? He's speaking about the scriptures. The church is instructing the Christian scriptures in the Bible, so he can learn, so he can have strength for his journey. And then the next day, it says they took him into the armory, where they showed him all manner of furniture which their Lord had provided for pilgrims: a sword, a shield, a helmet, a breastplate, all prayer, he calls it, and shoes that wouldn't wear out. That's almost straight from Ephesians chapter 6 about the armor of God, where we're told to put on the armor of God so that we can stand in the day of battle, which Christian was getting ready to face as he left that place. As we leave the church on Sunday and head into the world on Monday, we need to go equipped with the armor of God about us so that we can withstand the temptations and attacks of the evil one, of the world, the flesh, and the devil, and so that we can do God's work and preach the gospel, bring the gospel to the nations in our everyday life. And they show him ancient things. They show him Moses' rod, the nail with which Jael slew Sisera, the things which Gideon used to put to flight the army of Midian. This is the Old Testament. So they instructed him on the previous day in the Gospels and Acts and maybe the epistles. And then now they're in the Old Testament. So there's just an enormous amount of instruction that is going on in the church. And we ought to think of the church that way, as the place even primarily in which we are instructed in the ways of the Lord, in which we're taught the scriptures, in which the Lord of the church, Christ, can be heard in his church through the preaching and teaching of his word. I mean, that's the way that Christ exercises his lordship over the church, is to have called and equipped and gifted men of God teach the people what Christ has set forth in the scriptures. So Bunyan's teaching us that that's what the church is. Well, then another day passes, still at the palace. So it's a long time of refreshment. And they go to show him the Delectable Mountains, which are what it sounds like. They're the Delectable Mountains, and that I think symbolizes heaven. It's not quite the celestial city, but it's the Delectable Mountains just outside of it, which act as a sign of heaven itself. And by that, I reason that the church gives hope, that the church not only nourishes and gives rest and instructs, but it gives hope. The church is constantly to push the Christians to look toward their eternal reward, that you're not far off, that heaven is within reach, that it's only a few more years and Christ will take us to himself, to always keep the end in mind. Peter talks about this in 1 Peter 1 in a passage that I think does us much good, be worth putting to memory. 1 Peter 1:13, therefore, prepare your minds for action. Keep sober in spirit. Fix your hope completely on the grace to be brought to you at the revelation of Jesus Christ. Put your hope completely on receiving that grace when Christ comes or when he brings you to himself. That's how you'll be prepared for action and keep sober, if you keep the glories of heaven in view. And it says they also see, he asked the name of the country where the Delectable Mountains were, and to look south, and there's a great distance where a pleasant mountainous country. And what's the name? And he said, it's Emmanuel's land. It's the land for all the pilgrims. And when you come there, from there, you'll see the gate of the celestial city, and the shepherds that live there will appear. Well, he gets ready to move on from the palace, but before he can leave, there's one more thing that the church does: nourishes, gives rest, instructs, gives hope, and fifth, it equips. The church equips, not only by its instruction, but by its discipleship and the giving of this Christian armor. They said, let us go again into the armory. And so when he came there, they harnessed him from head to foot with what was of proof, lest perhaps he should meet with assaults in the way. So they gave him good armor so that he could be protected. And he went to the gate and he got ready to leave. He began to go forward, it says, but discretion, piety, charity, and prudence, those were the four women who discoursed with him upon his entry and throughout his stay. So they wanted to accompany him down to the foot of the hill. So remember, he went up the hill difficulty to get to the Palace Beautiful. Now he's going to go down the hill difficulty back in the way. And they say, we want to go with you. We don't want to have you leave the house. We're coming with you to the valley. And it says, as it was difficult coming up, it is dangerous going down. And this just reminds me and us that we have to come down the mountain. We can't live at church. We can't have a perpetual Sabbath. We can't be on the Mount of Transfiguration the whole time, right? Peter says, Lord, it's good for us to be here. Let's build tabernacles and stay up here, and you can discourse with the Father, and Moses and Elijah can hang out, and we're going to have a blast. Well, that's not why Christ has kept us in the world, to be shuttered away, in a convent or in a monastery. No, we do gather, and we treasure the gathering, but we gather in order to scatter, in order to be equipped to take the gospel to the world, to serve the world, and to make those whom Christ has made to be his to come to faith, to bring the gospel to the ones that God has chosen to save. We need to enjoy the heights, but it's true, isn't it, that the heights are often followed by valleys. And that's what we're going to see next time, that a wonderful, encouraging, refreshing time at the Palace Beautiful leads to the Valley of Humiliation.